In a groundbreaking study of Masonic architecture from the 1870s to the 1930s, William Moore explains the central conceit of the Masonic ritual in the period under examination was that ancient Freemasons were employed in constructing King Solomon's temple on Mount Moriah in pre-Christian Jerusalem. This temple was erected by King Solomon, the son of David, to house the Ark of the Covenant. According to the Masonic fraternity's account, Solomon invited stoneworkers from throughout the known world to labor on the temple. Having gathered them together at Jerusalem, he organized this international, multicultural group of craftsmen into a single corporate body by imposing upon them a system of laws and customs for their government. Freemasonry, as it was practiced at the end of the 19th century, supposedly derived from these royal edicts. Based upon this precedent, ideally, men of any nationality were welcomed into the Brotherhood. Freemasonry was believed to be an elevated school of moral culture that could bind together individuals of divergent ethnic and cultural background. American Freemasons viewed themselves as the heirs of the craftsmen who erected Jehovah's Temple on Mount Moriah, but they also differentiated themselves from what they believed were their ancient brethren. The craftsmen who built Solomon's Temple practiced what the 19th century fraternity termed operative masonry, while modern Freemasonry was identified as speculative. Operative masonry erected structures out of stone. Speculative masonry employed symbols and concepts related to architecture to build character among the fraternity's membership. The ethical and spiritual practices of the Brotherhood were believed to have been evolved from the practices of stone masons' guilds. While operative masons used tools to shape stone, speculative masons utilized these same implements as didactic devices with which to inculcate moral lessons. The square, therefore, in speculative masonry was used to convey concepts of rectitude. As by the application of the square, the stone is tried and proved so. And Albert Mackey, one of the influential mid-century writers, wrote, "The compass, which often accompanies the square, is used to draw the limits of correct behavior." Similarly, a gavel or hammer was used in actual labor to shape a stone so that it could be fitted into a wall. In the Masonic system, Robert McCoy explained, it is employed as a symbol by which the Mason is constantly admonished to divest his mind and conscience of all vices and errors in life. In this fashion, the Masonic ritual provided Freemasons with a metaphoric architectural vocabulary with which to comprehend moral behavior. Solomon's Temple, the trope of that construction, allowed the members of the fraternity to assume symbolically the archetypal construct of the heroic artisan. Time spent working towards the fraternity's goals came to be called laboring in the quarries. Writers such as the influential minister Joseph Fort Newton claimed that Masons were building the fabric of brotherhood or were working to erect a better society. In his view, each member of the fraternity represented an ashlar, that is, a living stone in the mythic Masonic temple. Lawrence Greenleaf, a prolific American Masonic poet, presented a rhymed account of the fraternity's goals in a work titled The Temple of Living Masons, which begins, "The temple made of wood and stone will crumble and decay, but there's a viewless fabric which shall never fade away." And that, in fact, has provided a kind of paradox. The building made of wood and stone will crumble and decay, but the symbolic building they were constructing would never fade away. William Moore, in his study titled Masonic Temples, suggests by the start of the 1930s, there were Masonic halls or temples that had been constructed in most major communities in the country, Scranton among them. The tension the poet expressed has been experienced by each and every one of those structures erected right up into the 1930s. That is the crumbling and decaying part. On November 19th of this year, the Scranton Cultural Center at the Masonic Temple held a press conference for the media and invited guests to witness the unveiling of its newly restored Harry and Jeanette Weinberg Theater. The theater had been closed to the public for renovations as part of a large-scale restoration process funded by the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania's Department of General Services. The building has a remarkable history, and it has played a significant role in the life of the community from the start. John Cardoni is general manager of the Scranton Cultural Center, and he's been on site for 25 years. He paid a visit to the WVIA studios to talk about what we might call the life of the building and its recent revitalization. History first.
The building in and of itself was a spectacular achievement for 1930 Scranton. It is a remarkable piece of architecture. The Masonic Temple Association, which represented the various Masonic lodges in and about the city of Scranton, had decided that they needed a new centralized building. They had actually been in the old Scranton Armory, which was over in the 300 block of downtown, and the Scranton Guard, or whatever they were called at that point, had just left to go into what was then called the Watrous Armory, which is now privately held by an artist with his collection in it. So this building was vacant, and the Masons moved in there. They purchased it, and they discovered it still wasn't large enough. So the board met several times. They contacted the architecture department at the University of Pennsylvania, and the University of Pennsylvania actually ran a competition for the design of what was then going to be known as the Masonic Temple and Scottish Rite Cathedral. Five finalists were chosen, and one of them, the winner ultimately, was Raymond Hood. Raymond Hood, remarkable history on him, died very young, unfortunately, but in his short career designed the McGraw-Edison Building in New York, the Chicago Tribune Building, the New York Daily News Building, and was one of the principal architects on the Rockefeller Center. He died well before the completion of the Rockefeller Center, and we are the benefit of that. Long before the term copy and paste existed, though, we can see from looking at his designs where he took elements from some of those buildings and moved them to Scranton. And we're grateful for that because it makes the building so much more spectacular to look at. The Masons had provided a set of guidelines in terms of what the rooms should contain or be able to contain, but it was always intended from day one to be both a public and a Masonic facility. So from the day it opened, we've always had public activity in that building, which was very unique. Most Masonic temples were built for Masonic activities only. They might have a separated section for retail, rental, or whatever, but this was always designed to be a public use access. And our records show that the building opened with a dedication service in May of 1930, after almost 3 years of construction. And immediately after that, there was a large banquet by what was called the Republican Women's Victory Committee. And we have a photograph of that dinner where there's 1,100 people jammed into the grand ballroom, shoulder to shoulder, all smiling, ashtrays on all the tables, and no air conditioning. And it's in May. It must have been just overwhelming. And from that point forward, the Masonic Temple has played a pivotal role in the life of downtown Scranton, whether it was for these kind of banquets or for fundraisers or for Broadway or concerts. Broadway Theater League, which had recently celebrated, I believe, its 60th year, has always been housed there, bringing national Broadway shows to the Scranton and greater Scranton area. And with that, the building really has just hummed ever since its grand opening. But as with most Masonic institutions, it depended on membership to be able to get the dues for the support money to pay the staff and the electric bills. I don't have to tell anyone out there listening about the increasing costs these days, but those costs in 1970, 40 years after they opened, were more than the membership could bear. And over time, various parts of the building were left to the ravages of time, let's call it. Things couldn't be replaced or repaired as quickly as they would like or at all in some cases. And finally, the building got to the point where it was going to be sold for non-payment of taxes, because Masonic fraternities are not considered charitable organizations in the state of Pennsylvania. And so they had a heavy tax burden to the city. They had sewer bills and electric bills like we all do, but on a scale that some would not be able to imagine. And they were about to go under, and that building was going to go up for public auction. I can't imagine what that would have been like. But fortunately, there was a group of people in the city of Scranton who wanted an arts center. And at the same time, this is 1985, Governor Casey had been hearing rumblings from the city of Wilkes-Barre and our old friend Al Boscov about putting a performing arts center in Wilkes-Barre. And I'm in that unique position where I opened the Kirby Center in 1986, and then I got to go to the Scranton Cultural Center and work through all of this. So the funding from the governor for the city of Wilkes-Barre got matched for this arts committee to use and live in the Masonic Temple, now known as the Scranton Cultural Center at the Masonic Temple. And with that $8 million kickoff enabled them to put the building into decent standing, improving the electrical systems and upgrading some of the plumbing, putting air conditioning in the theater, which had not existed, and doing a lot of repair work that was generally needed just to make the building safe and livable. The Scranton Cultural Center, in turn, went out and raised funds over time to do a lot more. And now we find ourselves here in the cusp of the 96th year of its operation, with just about completing 9/10 of a restoration project funded by the state of Pennsylvania. And I should mention that the ownership and all this, how this moves, is that the state of Pennsylvania under Governor Casey took the deed for the Scranton Cultural Center and gave it to the Historical and Museum Commission. So the PA Historical and Museum Commission is the technical owner of the building, but with the caveat that the Scranton Cultural Center is responsible for paying all the bills and moving all the projects forward to maintain and operate the building. The Masonic Temple Association is responsible for making sure that the Masons pay their rent, as well as they contribute to a lot of the projects that we do, because now their diminished membership still is profitable enough to have some money, but not enough to operate the building. And that is not a nutshell of how we got to where we are.
But it's important, John, to get the impact of the renovations. You mentioned that grand event in the ballroom with the Republican women early on. There are spaces in the building that are multiple use, or they're able to be flexible. So that does give you even more ways to configure the space.
Absolutely. The versatility of that building is tremendous. We have a room on the fourth floor that is known as Shopland Hall, that to the public looks like a small theater, an odd theater in that it's got pews at right angles on the side and in the balcony. And well, it was originally a Masonic meeting room, and it has a small stage at one end of it. And when people walk in, they see the elegant arched ceilings and the leaded glass windows. They would have originally seen a deep red carpet throughout the entire area, and the Masonic furniture in place. It was just being set up for a room, but we use that to house our children and youth theater program in terms of a lot of their younger performances. It's used for private parties, wedding ceremonies. We've had memorial services there. I'd be remiss if I didn't mention our good friend, Fran McMullen, who was my longtime friend and yours and a colleague, worked with me in both the Kirby Center and the Cultural Center for years, passed away earlier this year, and we held his memorial service there just to honor him. He was deeply committed to history and the preservation of that building. And a lot of what I do these days is in honor and memory of him. So thanks, Fran, for keeping us honest on that. But that's certainly some of the uses that space is put to. Our third floor has a Gothic cathedral-like ceilinged room with lots of glass and a cork floor And it can be used for meetings, dinners, rehearsals. It was originally the billiard room. And you have to remember that part of what Raymond Hood was tasked with by the Masons in 1930 wasn't just building a building that could house the Masons, but also could entertain people. So it was a 1930s version of an entertainment complex. So you had three commercial-grade slate pool tables. The cork floor was there in case the balls fell off the table because there was no ball return system. They were just woven leather pockets underneath the balls, and they would hit the floor and it could crack. So this was to dampen that sound and preserve them. The light was so everyone could see, because it's 1930. Probably the brightest light that was in the room was a 40-watt light bulb. And that room was eventually converted by the Masons to be more of a dinner space, because there was always food with a lot of Masonic activities. And then over time, it served as a short while as the Scranton Cultural Center's offices while our other offices were being readied. And now it serves back to that original sort of Masonic purpose.
I just set before you, John, a bowling pin from the bowling alley of the Scranton Cultural Center.
I have one of those too. You know, these are rare, so I have one in my office. And not only can you tell it from the wear and tear on it and the Queen Bowling Pin Company label on it, but if you look at the bottom, it's drilled out. And it's drilled out because the bowling alley, which we haven't discussed yet, had a manual pin setting system. So what was referred to back then as a pin boy would be in a little gallery above the pins. And after the ball came down and through the pins, he would step on a foot lever and 10 rods would come up from the floor and seat in the bottom of the pins that were still vertical. And then they could clear the pins out of the way. The pit boy would do that. Then they'd lower them for the next ball. And then they would push them back up and set pins on them again. Yeah, this is rare. So a lot of the pins that were there, the bowling equipment, everything was removed in the late 1990s, because one of the unfortunate parts of that building was the lack of restroom facilities, especially for women. And there was an old tome that was around forever and ever, that if you attended a show at the Scranton Cultural Center or the Masonic Temple before that, and you were a woman, you had to make a decision. Did you wait till intermission to go to the restroom and then stand in line and miss the first 20 minutes of Act Two because there were so few facilities? Or did you get up partway through Act One and miss the end of Act One to do that? So the Cultural Center, that was one of the first things. The bowling alleys had long been in disuse. They were being used as a storage area. So everything was removed. The wooden materials were removed and they were sold to another bowling alley for incorporation into that. And that large space was turned into modern restrooms. Our marketing offices and the Department of General Services for the state of Pennsylvania has temporary offices there right now during our restoration work. And the facility offices where I live. And there are no windows. If anyone's listening from the Department of General Services, we'd really like windows down in the basement. So I went from one office to another in that building, but none of which have windows. But we do have now a very large, spacious restroom for the women. And part of the next phase of work, which we'll get to in a little while, will be improving the other restrooms. But I was saying before, part of the building's multiple use, that room now on the third floor, which is called Craftsman Hall now, in honor of the craftsman that built the Masonic Temple, that now is used as a dinner space most of the time. We've had conferences in there, and we've done wedding ceremonies because it looks like a chapel. And the Masons still use that floor. There are two lodge rooms on that floor for their meetings, and they will do it for their dinners before or after their meetings. So it's one of the busiest spaces in the building. Our second floor has what was originally a formal lending library for members, and then a room that is a little antiquated in its name. It's called the Ladies Parlor, and we have a naming opportunity there when we get a donor, the right donor for it. But the Ladies Parlor was designed for all of the women's auxiliary groups that existed in conjunction with the Masonic lodges. And so they had their own meeting room. It had its own access to the main kitchen. It had its own entrance, a stairwell, an exit stairwell, so they could come and go as they wanted without being interfered with. as the men could go up to the third or fourth floors and do their thing. And then you get to the main lobby where people walk all the time along the length of that lobby and don't realize there are two large pocket doors, brass and leather, ensconced with lion's heads that can be pulled out to separate the lobby into three sections. So people attending a banquet would enter through the patio doors. People attending the theater would enter through the theater lobby doors, and people who were coming for Masonic activities would enter the center doors and go on the elevators to the upper floors. It was just a fascinating use. And as we just said, there was a bowling alley. So in addition to the dressing rooms and a room called the exhibition room, which was for traveling exhibitions of museum materials and shows, that's the layout of the building. Most of it is accessible space. You know, there's a couple that aren't. The mezzanine lobby, so those of you who attend shows, if you need to be considered for handicap access, you have that on the first floor in the orchestra section. We can't get you to the balcony for that. And there are some stairwells that lead to storage spaces and other spaces that were mostly Masonic storage or equipment storage that wouldn't be considered accessible today. You couldn't build the building today. The material costs alone would exceed $200 million. And if you could find the craftsmen to do it, it would be probably another $100 million. And the Masons did it with the help of the general public in 1930 for $2.2 million furnished. And that money, again, was raised publicly and privately because of the intent. So it was a very successful marriage then. It continues to be a successful marriage today between the Masons, the Scranton Cultural Center, and the state of Pennsylvania. And we have a new member of the group, our friends at Broadway Theater, who I said are surpassed 60 years. And we kind of looked at things together. And Brian Calley and his board for the Broadway Theater League and John Murray and the board of the Scranton Cultural Center worked for the last few years on how to best do this. And we recently had a press conference where we announced that Broadway Theater League has officially merged into the Scranton Cultural Center. And we brought them on board. They are now, you know, co-directors with us and are equally responsible for the activities in there as we are. It's been an education on both sides for us. It's been relatively unbumpy, and as with anything like this, new eyes are always good. As I said to you pre-interview, I've been there for 25 years now, so I might not always see or be looking to see the things that fresh eyes do, and there's been a lot of fresh eyes lately that just help us do and provide a better product for the people at large.
Well, tell us, John, then, what were the priorities in terms of this renovation activity? Certain things you don't want ceilings to fall in. That's top of the list.
I think that's always a good idea. We had a unique situation there. The theater proper had what was known as Celotex tile, which was a wood fiber product made in Philadelphia, of all places. It doesn't exist anymore, where they would fuse it with glue, make these square tiles. They were perforated, and they were an acoustic product. And those were glued to the plaster ceiling of the auditorium. And then wired through that were these lightweight plastic medallions. So that was a lot of the decoration of the ceiling. Over time, the mastic adhesive started to give way on the back of those tiles. They would loosen from the ceiling, and then the only thing holding them in place if they were on a medallion was the medallion wiring, which was still safe. We had assessed that. But the ones that didn't have anything, every time we had a loud concert with a sound check in the afternoon where they were really wailing on the bass drum, we'd get one or two tiles that would fall. I said they were lightweight. They were under 8 ounces. So we weren't worried particularly about anyone being hurt, but being surprised in the middle of a show with something landing in your lap is never a good thing. And so every show, we would go around with poles and poke at the ceiling, just to make sure that we had knocked down anything that could have potentially fallen. That was just one of the problems inside the theater. The wall stenciling, and a lot of people mistakenly thought we had wallpaper, but it was all painted and hand stenciled, was cracking. Paint was peeling in several spots. We had water leaking through the roof structure. The temporary repairs that we'd done in 2002 with the assistance of the state in a previous grant were finally at the end of their life cycle. All of this combined to start wearing on the overall aesthetic of the room. Add to that that the walls themselves had lived to see all 90 plus years of exposure. So dust, dirt, nicotine, back when they allowed smoking everywhere, all of that was embedded in the walls. There had been several repairs done when the Masons had the building and early when the first cultural center first existed, and that included some plaster and repainting, but each repainting was matching the then dirty color of the paint that was there, so it wouldn't stand out. So you had all of that. Wear and tear in the back corridors, stairwells that had bad lighting, and that's just in the theater. In our grand ballroom, we again had a plaster and paint issue, and there's stenciling in there that was coming down. We had a number of the original stained glass windows where glass had broken, the leading had failed, so they were no longer resistant to wind and rain like they had been originally. Our original wooden doors, except for the two main entrance ones, which we had recently refinished, were falling to pieces. And then stone work on the exterior of the building, the mortar cracking, allowing water in. And then you get to the roofs, and you have an entire roof system needed to be replaced, as well as the guttering, and all of that was staring us in the face. And we've known that for a while. When Matthew Flynn was alive as our executive director, he and I started to approach the various state entities about coming up with more funding for the center. And each subsequent director, ending with Deb Peterson, our current executive director, carried a lot of water to the folks in Harrisburg. And our friends on the board, and our friends on what was then the Broadway Theater League board, and the county commissioners in Scranton, and our local state, as well as federal representatives, all know the importance of this building to the economy of downtown Scranton and to the arts in general of the area. So they all helped carry water to the state and the Department of General Services. And several years back, we were able to secure an initial $10 million appropriation through the state. And then administrations change, priorities change, it gets put on the back burner, it moves to the front burner, and then we had COVID and everything slammed to a stop. And we finally got it moving again. An architectural firm was selected, Highland Associates out of Clark Summit. They developed the full scope of what we could do with the money that we had, not anticipating the current inflationary spikes we're on with materials and deliverables. That all impacted us pretty severely to the point where we've calculated that our buying power was reduced by about $3.5 million over the course of the finally getting the money to market. And so we had to limit what we did, but the theater and the ballroom and the exterior were critical. So John Canning and Company out of New York, a worldwide mastery of architectural restoration firm, they were selected to do the work. D&M Construction out of the Scranton area were the project managers. Trivet Electric was doing our electric work. And the masonry and roofing work were under the auspices of D&M, but our friends at Dunmore Roofing got the bid for replacing the roof systems. And we started in earnest last year. We had some product delays, so we weren't able to really get things moving until the weather changed this year. And then because we have a theater schedule, we couldn't close the theater until June of this year. And we closed it after the final dance performance in June. And we reopened on November 17th, a Monday, fittingly enough with a Masonic ceremony in the theater, as they opened in 1930 with a Masonic dedication. And then 2 days later, we did Sesame Street Live, and then the Broadway run of Six, and followed that with a couple of performances by our friends at the Northeastern Pennsylvania Philharmonic, including most recently their holiday performance. We're in the middle of the Book of Mormon now. We had a fundraiser. We had Champions of Magic. We had Whiskey Myers, a country act. We had our youth program running full tilt. Everything that we would normally done from June through the end of October, we shoved into the last 6.5 weeks. I don't recommend it, but it's worked. And the detail of the restoration in the theater included replacing the proscenium arch, which I had never seen except in black and white photos. Apparently in the 1980s, during a weekend run, before anybody was in the hall, portion of the proscenium collapsed into the orchestra pit. And they, of course, canceled the show, and they took down the rest of the materials and determined that it was a matter of both age and the way it was erected and the inability of the building to be consistently heated that allowed for expansion and contraction, and the nails eventually gave way and it came out. That can't happen today. But to do that required finding a woodworker that could make custom knives to cut this various moldings that were in there, to have John Canning Associates being able to take plaster molds of the existing plaster work and cast new ones, to have D&M and their woodworkers and carpenters be able to make the frameworks to put up there, and then have Highland come up with an attachment system that would not be subject to heating or cooling, but that could fit in the same space. And all of it hinged on being able to find a photograph of what it looked like. And unfortunately, the 1930 photographs don't show that. They show an angle where you sort of see a shadow, but even enlarged and enhanced, you couldn't tell what it was. But Masons are known sort of as the nation's attic, that they're not known for throwing anything out. So we went looking, and we found all of Raymond Hood's original drawings and designs stored away, labeled, and we found a full-scale drawing that's 12 feet by 9 feet of the proscenium arch angle details and then the layout. And with that, we were able to proceed, and it's been fully restored. We're working on putting in some lighting to show the newly replaced ceiling and the proscenium arch, and the colors are stunning. I mentioned earlier about nicotine and dirt, but when you actually cleaned the original plaster down, everything was so much more vibrant. And that makes sense, given that back in the day, the lighting in there would have been so much dimmer than what we're able to do today. So it's just been stunning and very gratifying to be able to be a part of this. And I couldn't be prouder. Speaking for myself, to be able to be part of the region's two foremost performing arts centers and getting them opened in a different grand way each, it's just been an honor all the way around.
John Cardoni, General Manager of the Scranton Cultural Center at the Masonic Temple, speaking about the history of the building and the major restoration of the structure, a chance to restore, among other things, the handsome proscenium arch in the theater to its original glory. The Scranton Cultural Center at the Masonic Temple is located at 420 North Washington Avenue. And as John told us, Broadway Theater League of Northeast Pennsylvania has merged with the Cultural Center. And so the touring shows will continue in 2026, part of the 2025-2026 season. It's Kinky Boots, getting underway February 13th, 14th, and 15th. Chicago, March 6th, 7th, and 8th. Clue, April 24th, 25th, and 26th. And The Music Man, June 12th through the 14th. For more information about the Scranton Cultural Center and its events, ScrantonCulturalCenter.org, ScrantonCulturalCenter.org. The Scranton Cultural Center at the Masonic Temple, located at 420 North Washington Avenue in Scranton. For more information, ScrantonCulturalCenter.org.